what a June the 15th I will remember as Black Tuesday. The sweet oblivion of sleep I would have loved until noon, but alas, I woke fairly early. Lyndon, dark-countenanced, dour and grim, I tried to comfort, not to much effect. His feelings were made up of many things, not only the disasters of the art festival and the constant black background of Vietnam and Santo Domingo, but most especially today, the death of young Bobby Russell, 40, handsome, father of five beautiful youngsters, and the beloved of Dick Russell. When Lyndon is racked by grief, he shows it. In his face, in his voice, or more likely in his silence. It was a bad day. I called in Liz and Bess to have a post-mortem on the Festival of the Arts, and we discussed the one-by-one hammer blows of the front-page stories. New York Times, New York Herald Tribune, even the Washington Post. Accenting only Robert Lowell's not coming, John Hersey's coming and lecturing, Dwight MacDonald's passing around a petition to get his fellow guests to sign disapproving of the president's foreign policy. Some uncertainty whether he got 4 or 7 signatures out of the 300 or so guests. I'll take a 293-7 majority any time. But do you think that was the news? No, the fly on top of the feast. And indeed, a feast it had been. Helen Hayes and Marian Anderson and glorious Roberta Peters. And the whole cast of A Glass Menagerie. And Catherine Drinker Bowen and delightful Phyllis McGinley. Oddly enough, the women reporters saw it in perspective. As their stories came in one by one, Isabel Shelton, Marie Smith, Jerry Vanderhabel, and believe me, for once I read all the clippings. The second time in my life I remember doing it. The other time was when the boyhood home was dedicated. Much to Liz's grief, I never read them. Today I couldn't wait for the issue of the Evening Star to get out. All the women saw it in perspective, gave the great good parts their due, and the small dissensions their due, all save one, Mary McGrory, the best writer of all, and hers was as cruel and cutting a story as ever I remember. Liz says she's just born in the Boston ghetto and can't get out. I think Phyllis McGinley's own line about those who bear tolerance as a label but find some other views intolerable fitted the whole occasion admirably. Poor Dr. Goldman, he worked so hard, he did so much, he achieved such a lot. And yet the total result must have been a towering headache, if not heartbreak. Oddly enough, there descended upon me total weariness, total relaxation, and I went to bed and took a long, delicious nap. Then I got up and worked on the mail. Lyndon had asked me to substitute for him in receiving the inaugural committee workers at 5:30. They were going to present us the gold medallion for him, a silver one for the vice president, the first copy of a book that will go on sale for $10 to help finish out the expenses of the past inauguration and build up a nest egg for future ones, and then just a chance for us to say a last thank you, a sort of a reunion. And that was something I was mighty glad to do. So down to the East Room at 5:30 to see many familiar faces. I stood in line with Dale to greet the guests as they drifted in. Lindy Boggs, the Oscar Chapmans, advance men from the Lady Bird special, the Howard Burrises, the Warren Woodwards, all the committee chairmen and all the hard workers, some 300 folks, most of whom I knew, the Jackites. It was happy greeting and hugging and reminiscing all around, and then a very dignified and delightful little speech by Dale, a word of earnest thanks by me, and the acceptance of the most wonderful book of colored photographs of the inaugural that I have seen. I do not think there is its equal for any inauguration. And then Lyndon suddenly strode in and said, I think you've already had all the speeches, but I just want to tell you, Dale, it was the best inauguration any president ever had. He shook half a dozen hands and was gone back to his office in less than a count of 5 minutes. Not so Hubert Humphrey. He was with us the whole time, evanescent all around, got up and made a speech in which he said, "I enjoyed every living minute, and lest I be misunderstood, I wouldn't mind doing it all over again," to the great laughter of the room. Lucy Baines came in and covered the state dining room quickly, seeing lots of old friends here and there, and then in came Matiana. She and Tony were going to spend the night with us. But Tony had taken the children swimming, that is, Lisa, Alexander, and their little friend, and Diana. Later, I went upstairs to the West Hall, and Tony and Diana joined us, while the three children had an early supper upstairs on the stools at Lucy's bar in her solarium. I said, "Hello, Lisa. Hello, Sasha." And he says, "I charge a quarter for that." We all laughed, and he said, "My name's Alexander. I don't want anybody to call me Sasha anymore." How charming Lisa looked, like Alice in Wonderland, with long, fair hair and a ribbon around it, and wide eyes, and very thrilled to be here. And Tony's delight at seeing them so happy was a delight to me. The four of us had a good, long, happy talk about the Virgin Islands, Santa Fe, and my possible trip there this summer, their visit to the World Fair just completed, and Tony's new job, a sort of tryout one for AID in 6 countries of Latin America. And then I said, "Let's go into dinner, the four of us." The children were already downstairs at a movie, and there's never any telling when Lennon will come. Frequently it's 11. And so we did, and right in the middle of it, Lyndon joined us, looking tired and quiet, but very sweet. We kissed each other all around, and then we had that unusual thing, the family dinner, interrupted, of course, by a few phone calls. And a little later, to my pleasure, Lyndon said, "I think I'll go to bed. I don't believe I'll have my night reading tonight." However, a little later, I went in and found Tony in the rocking chair at Lyndon's request, and he, Lyndon, was stretched out on the massage table, having a rub, absorbing his night reading, with the TV turned on, to which he was utterly oblivious. Something comes on that he wants to hear. Some extra nerve alerts him. He stops reading, turns it up, and watches it. Otherwise, the noise doesn't seem to bother him in the least. Me, it drives mad. It was, however, one of the earliest nights in a long time for him. By midnight, we were both in bed. Linda had called me from Grasshopper, as she has every day. I think possibly she's lonesome. She told me that she had found a skeleton. It was probably 700 years old, the archaeologist told her. That would place it, pre-Columbian certainly, probably in the 13th century. She was engaged in very carefully scraping the bones to get off the incrustation of 700 years of dirt and pebbles. I gathered that she found that not the most exciting work in the world, and it seems that in every conversation she tells me, "Mama, we get up at 6 o'clock in the morning."